Welcome to the Disney Magic Podcast. I'm Joel.
And I'm Megan.
And we like talking about Disney things. Specifically this week, we're talking about Fantasia 2000.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to stop there, and I was like, Joel, we already did Fantasia. We're on a new movie.
We can talk a little bit about a little bit part of Fantasia again.
Yes, it's true.
So, Fantasia, so this is like the part where I always talk about when the movie premieres. And Fantasia 2000 has a crazy premiere thing, which was really interesting to read about. Because Fantasia 2000 premiered at Carnegie Hall on December 17th, 1999. And this was the opening of a five-city concert tour that included performances in London, Paris, Tokyo, and Pasadena.
One of these things is not like the others. I was like, large city, large city, large city. I mean, large city, but Pasadena?
Well, that one, I think they were close to that one.
That's funny.
After that, Fantasia 2000 got an exclusive release in IMAX theaters between January 1st and April 30th in 2000. And that made it the first animated feature-length film to be issued in IMAX. Huh. And then after that, it was had a wide release in the United States on June 16th, 2000.
Okay.
So.
That was complicated.
Yes. So Fantasia 2000 had like a long path to the theaters.
Yeah.
But it's also why it's called Fantasia 2000, even though it technically came out in 1999 and is a 1999 movie.
Yeah.
Because like the wide release and the IMAX release were both 2000s.
Right.
So, Fantasia 2000 was the soundtrack is performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and is conductor James Levine, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And so a lot of stuff says, you know, that this sequel was first conceived in 1974 by Roy E. Disney. It's also really kind of like was conceived when they made Fantasia because yeah. We talked a lot about it when we did the Fantasia podcast, but they do a lot of, you know, Fantasia was always going to be this, like, new version every year, and there'll be some old things, and there'll be some new things, and, you know, you'll always kind of get to see a new Fantasia experience.
Yeah.
And so, that didn't happen, because Fantasia didn't make the money that it needed to. But, the idea, I guess the revamped idea for a Fantasia sequel, was in 1974, but was not pitched to Michael Eisner until 1984, when I think there was like a limited release of the first Fantasia on VHS that did well enough that they started like, oh, we could do some more Fantasia. Early on, one possibility for a sequel was called Musicana, and would explore the world's cultures through different musical compositions from around the world.
That's cool.
That's a cool idea. And like, would be a cool, like, oh, the same but different kind of thing.
I would watch that.
No, I watch it. Like, what I really hope is I've been, like, reading about it and is like, I'm really ready for Fantasia 3.
Part 3, please. Yes.
Whatever they want to call it, because I really dug this movie.
I like this movie, too. And I really like the original, and I think it would be fun. They should do more.
Yeah. Well, this one, like, so, you know, the original Fantasia was, like, all made at once, but this one was, like, each segment was produced individually during, like, the production lulls in between their main features.
Right.
So they just kind of worked until, oh, we have enough for a movie now. and so because of that, though, this movie was like 9 years in the making.
Jeez.
So with Pines of Rome being the first segment to be completed and the Fifth Symphony to be the last sequence.
Oh.
So, but let's jump into Fantasia 2000.
Yes.
Which opens up with, like, this giant shot of the universe.
Yeah.
And it's stunning and gorgeous.
It is really pretty. And then there's some small clips from the original, which is a really nice touch.
Yeah, it's kind of this whole, like, previously on Fantasia.
Yeah, and then they kind of jump right into the first segment.
Yeah, the segment, the, like, the clips from the original Fantasia that they use kind of set up the three types of music that they talked about.
Right.
In the first one, with the one telling a story, one having distinct images, and then one just being, like, really abstract.
Yeah.
And so, like the last time, they start out with that third abstract thing with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and some triangle butterflies.
Yes. There's some butterflies. They're pretty upsetting butterflies.
Yeah.
There's, like... So it starts out with, like, just some, like, clouds and some water and some light. And then we get rocks. There's some weird-looking rocks. And a lot of butterflies. And then there's some crags and some evil butterflies. Which sounds so dumb, but they're very threatening. And
they're very mean butterflies, guys.
They are unfriendly serious. Butterflies, okay? And, they attack the other butterflies, and the butterfly get the, like, there's two little main butterflies, and the bigger of the two gets, like, beat up, and then you think he's dead. I thought he was dead anyway. He, like, vanished. He got sucked into a giant cloud of evil butterflies. And then there's some space, some outer space, yep. And some rainbows of protection. And then the butterfly comes back, and all the butterflies are okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot more for the colors than the story, and
butterflies, Joel. I had a lot of feelings about these butterflies.
Well, it was really interesting to me that they used Fifth Symphony, which, like, I don't know if it is the most famous piece of classical music, but it's one that, you know, I've always known, and, like,
yeah,
for being the Fifth Symphony, and it's one that learned about a lot in, like, elementary school.
Yep.
And so where, like, stuff like Rite of Spring, if I hear Rite of Spring, I think of Fantasia. I have no other context for that one. I only know it as this. But Fifth Symphony, I really know as the Fifth Symphony. So it's like I've already experienced this and have little visuals in my head of, like, oh, this music is happy. And, like, when they played that music is when the angry butterflies came up. And I was like, oh... Maybe it wasn't happy for you guys. Okay.
I like that they chose a pretty famous piece because it is really interesting to see how they interpret it in place of everybody else interpreting it. Like, you know, I'm very used to the song being, like, very angry or, like, serious. So it's nice to see rainbow butterflies.
No, it was cool that, like, you know, because so many of these, like, my only interpretation is going to be the one they give me.
Right.
And so to, like, get to see, like, you know, it's not better or worse or anything, but it's different.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, yeah, that's cool. And so within, we get this thing. So this happens throughout the movie where they have, like, celebrities introduce each segment. And so first up is Steve Martin. Who's, you know, Steve Martin is, like, really funny at talking directly to a camera.
He is really good at directly talking to cameras. It's true.
Which, like, I mean, that's something that some people are not very good at. And so, but he is really good, and he tries to play the violin, and he does a bad job of it.
It's pretty terrible, and also pretty delightful.
It is. And he also, they do this thing where he doesn't know when his little segment is over. And so he's trying to get the camera to focus back on him as it moves along.
There's Ed.
And so, and then this is Pines of Rome.
Yes.
Which is the whales.
Whales! So I haven't seen this movie in a really long time. I think probably the last time I saw this was 6th or 7th grade, and that is the only time I've seen it. And this was all I remembered about it. I remembered the whales. That's it.
So, okay. First of all, so, like, The animation and the music are, like, stupidly beautiful, both of them.
The animation is really good, but it's still early on in the, like, attempting to combine CG and traditional. So there's, like, certain moments where I'm like, that whale looks so awkward. What are you doing with that whale? But the backgrounds are gorgeous.
Yes, they do the Northern Lights for a segment, and I was like, look at those.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really good. The music is obviously fantastic.
Yeah.
But the story is kind of like,
what? So there's these whales. They're normal whales at first. We just get like a shot of like what looks like, I don't know, like the North or South Pole. I don't know. There's lots of ice and some whales and some birds. And then at some point they decide that water isn't cool enough. And they just start flying.
Whales can fly. Flying. Because.
There's no, like, there's a really bright star in the sky, and I think they tried to connect those, but it didn't really work very well.
Here's the thing. On the Wikipedia page, I went and observed this, and so the plot for this segment is, according to Wikipedia,
flying whales.
A family of humpback whales are able to fly due to a supernova. So, I don't, like, that never came across to me. But maybe that's what the bright light was?
Okay. I don't really see how those two things interact with each other.
And even then, I don't know when we all agreed that supernovas gave whales flying abilities.
That's so weird. What?
And the thing is that these whales are really good at flying. This clearly isn't their first time flying.
No.
Except for the baby, because, you know, there's this baby humpback whale who's clearly flying for the first time because he's still working on it.
Baby whale.
And so this baby kind of like, he's tormenting some birds because he's having fun flying.
Yep.
And so then the birds chase him.
And then he gets stuck in this...
He kills them with some ice.
Yeah, and then he gets stuck in this cave.
And so, like, you know, they have these concerned parent whales. And I was like, oh, like your whale is going to drown. And I was like, oh, whales totally can drown.
I was just thinking, like, you know, he would get stuck in the cave and then he'd have nothing to eat. And then he'd just starve to death. And baby whale starving to death is a sad thing, Joel.
Well, you know what? It's okay. Because he found this pillar of light that beamed him up Star Trek style and beamed him out of the ice cave.
I'm really not sure what's going on in the sequence.
This sequence is clearly more experimental than the previous intended experimental piece that we watched.
I understood the butterfly plot line a lot better than I understood the humpback whales who fly.
Because
they're supernovas.
So, the baby whale and the mama whale are reunited, and then they get a lot of whales to fly.
A whole pod of whales.
And there's
a group of whales is called a pod. Pod.
Yeah, but now that they're in the air, I think they're a fleet.
I think it's a flock, then, like birds.
A flock. I accept the flock of whales.
Flock of whales.
So this flock of whales is continuing to fly higher and higher, and they kind of like run into this storm mountain.
There's like a cloud bank that's angry, and then they like break through the top of the cloud bank, and there's water.
So my interpretation of this
is it a metaphor, Joel?
Well, I think it's supposed to be something along the lines of like they're breaking through the real water at the end. They're doing underwater stuff the whole time, but like, water is like flying in the, like, you have the up and down, left and right kind of thing that you don't have on land. And so it's this, you know, flying and swimming are similar. And so
a
lot of interpretation there, no matter what you do.
I think that some animators really wanted to animate some whales. And they got really tired of drawing bubbles. So they decided that flying would be more fun.
I mean, whatever it is, they drew flying whales.
Yes.
There's no argument that there are flying whales in this, because flying whales.
Flying whales.
So, I mean, it was a very enjoyable piece. I was never bored.
Yes, no.
Throughout this whole thing.
It was enjoyable and very odd.
Yes.
At the same time.
So, I'm really interested in the decisions on, like, how to order these, because, like, to put this one second when you might not be, like, fully into the idea of Fantasia yet.
Yeah. And instead, like, of doing something more structured, you're going to have flying whales.
Yeah, okay. Like, so the first thing is, like, the bizarre abstract thing, and then the second thing is the whales that fly.
That's true. I mean, I guess because most people were familiar with Fantasia the original by this point, that they just assumed that you'd be down for anything in the first place. Yep. I don't know.
But we move on.
Yes.
From the Wheels to Rhapsody in Blue.
Who introduces this? I can't remember.
Oh, no, I didn't write it down.
Neither did I.
I assumed I would have remembered, but I didn't.
Oh.
But this one, this segment is my favorite in this movie.
This is definitely up there for me. I really, really like this segment. I like Gershwin in general.
Yep.
So the song is very familiar to me, and the animation that they put with it is really just charming and awesome.
It is. I really like the story of this one, which is kind of a, just, you know, average day in New York kind of thing. But it's really impressive. You know, okay, I'm like constantly a little bit impressed that they can, like, tell this story to this pre-established piece of music and make it make sense as well as it does every single time.
Yeah, it's true.
And so this time they're taking four completely different stories that interact very slightly and are still able to use this one single piece of music and make it all fit and flow so well.
It's true. This one starts out with just a sketch of buildings in New York City, kind of like an Etch-a-Sketch. Like, it's all done just in lines, which is cool.
It's a very abstract way of drawing.
Yeah.
And so, like, a lot of minimalist kind of stuff.
The first character that we're introduced to is the drummer.
Yes. Everybody's named in this, by the way, even though they never say it.
Oh, are they?
I didn't know. This guy's name is Duke.
Oh.
The construction worker. And we also are introduced to this guy who's named Jobless Joe. Because he doesn't have a job.
That's sad.
It's kind of hard to have one when you name Jobless Joe.
It's true.
There's also a little girl named Rachel, who is, I guess her parents are some sort of, like, upper class people.
Yeah.
Because she has lots of, you know,
lessons.
She has lessons in everything. She has some sort of nanny? That's taking her. There's this portly fellow named John, who the animators sometimes called Flying John, who is totally Mr. Snoops from The Rescuers.
He does really look like Mr. Snoops. You're right. I didn't notice that.
Absolutely. 100%.
So we get a bit of introduction to the city as well. There's a really cute scene with a doorman at a hotel. And the people keep coming in and out, and he just keeps getting more and more frazzled. There's a scene on the subway shortly after, and up in a high-rise skyscraper building. And there's scenes with each of the main characters. We get introduced to Duke. Duke, yes, okay.
Yeah, Duke first.
It's gonna be so problematic.
Each one has something that they long for, I guess.
Yeah.
Or, like, yeah, this dream. And so Duke, who's a construction worker, really wants to be a drummer.
Yeah.
Joe wants a job, I guess, or, and, you know, the financial security that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. Rachel, I guess, wants a family, or at least wants her parents to pay attention to her.
Yeah, she just wants her parents to hang out with her more.
Yeah, because she does have parents, and we see the parents, but, like, she's so busy doing other stuff.
And they're kind of absent.
And John wants to have fun, maybe? Like,
I think that he wants to be free. His wife is kind of crazy, and I
think... That's the thing, is, like, there wasn't really any way I could think of to, like, express it without, like, his dream is for his wife to go away.
He wants his independence. How's that?
I like that. That sounds so much nicer.
Yes, because his
wife... you're supposed to cheer for him.
He's crazy. So we see all of Rachel's lessons.
This was insanely funny.
That was my favorite sequence. So she goes to singing lessons, swimming lessons, art lessons, gymnastics, tennis, piano, and ballet. Yeah.
And she is, like, you know, kind of behind in all... Obviously, she's behind in all her lessons because she's taking all of them.
Yep.
She shouldn't have time to practice.
And if this is one day, Lord knows what she has to do on other days.
Yep. But that was very entertaining. I really like Duke, like, just kind of hanging out at his job, having fun, being innovative. And I also really liked, there's one sequence where Jobless Joe is, like, has found an apple that's rolled onto the street, and he's, like, wrestling with this whole moral dilemma that he has, whether or not to put the apple back or to eat it, because he's so hungry. And he's finally gonna put this apple back, and it's hurting him so bad. And this police comes up and yells at him for stealing the apple.
Yep.
And then the policeman eats the apple.
Yep.
And it's so funny and heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah.
So, but the whole scene kind of comes to a head when they're all the four main characters are kind of looking out the window and longing for their whatever their preference is, and they see some people ice skating and kind of imagine their lives better, and Duke's the guy that decides to shape up and do something about it.
Yes, it's true. He quits his job and by association of being there, luckily Jobless Joe gets his job.
Yep. So, and then, like, but because Jobless Joe is new to the job, he accidentally, like, reels
crane
in
lifts.
Crane lifts. What's John's wife away from John, so John's free to run and play with the dancing showgirls.
Yep.
And meanwhile, Duke, who is running to a talent night, you know, knocks this ball that Rachel has dropped out of a window, which bounces off windows, alerting Rachel's mom and dad that Rachel's about to run out into the street, and they run to save her. And this reunites them as a family so that they can hang out together, and they get rid of the nanny.
Yep.
And so everybody has a happy ending, and that's just, like, the most adorable, sweet little ending that could happen here. And again, like, all of this crazy happenstance stuff that all has to happen at exact moments all fits so perfectly to this music.
Yes.
Which I'm just, like, completely floored with every time I think about it.
It's true. So, I really like the kind of loose, sketchy style that this is in. And the colors are really cool. It's not, like, it's mostly just block colored, which is really neat. And I like how all the stories fit together. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. This animation's also a lot more, I guess, cartoony is the best word. Like, it's over the top. You know, people are falling from giant buildings and crashing into things the way, like, you know, Bugs Bunny cartoons and stuff would happen. So, next up, is Bette Midler.
Yes.
Comes to, and so she mentions the idea of, you know, additional segments at points and segments that were cut from the original Fantasia including the Ride of the Valkyries that we talked about in the earlier podcast, as well as Salvador Dali doing some baseball thing.
Yes, which looked odd. I know that there is a short film that he did with Disney, and I've seen bits and pieces of it. I've never seen the whole thing. But it just seems like a very strange combination.
Yep. She also mentions that there was going to be a bug ballet, is what she calls it, and it was totally Flight of the Bumblebee that was in Melody Time.
Oh.
They played like a few chords of Flight of the Bumblebee, and it was a segment. It was called, I think it was called Bumble Boogie or something like that.
Yeah. I remember that.
Yep.
Way back in the day.
Yeah, back then, back to segments, the package films.
Yep.
But this is all used to introduce the Steadfast Tin Soldier, which was originally going to be in the original Fantasia, but no one could decide what music to set it to, which led to it being cut out. And this is, outside of the Pixar films, which had been going on for a while now, since 95, this segment is the first time that lead characters in a Disney animation are completely computer generated.
Yep.
So, which I thought was really, really cool. Like, I really liked this kind of weird, blocky computer animation that they used for this.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of dated now, but it doesn't look bad. And the characters are really likable. I like all the designs.
And the fact that these main characters are also toys, it kind of is acceptable how stilted kind of the movement is. So, which, you know, would have been a lot worse if these were real people, I think, that were supposed to have, like, more expressive faces than these guys did.
So there's basically three characters to this. The ballerina, the really creepy Jack in the Box.
Oh my goodness, that Jack in the Box was so creepy!
That's so creepy. And, the Tin Soldier.
Yes.
So, when he's first introduced, he comes out of the box, and he's hopping along in the line. And, like, they clearly make reference to the fact that he has one leg. And he sees this ballerina from afar, and she's standing on one leg, so he thinks she has one leg. So he's like, well, I guess I have a chance with this girl who also has one leg. And then when he figures out she has two, he's, like, absolutely crushed. I'm really sorry this girl has both legs.
Yep, but she's touched because he gave her a flower.
Yes.
But the only problem is the scariest Jack in the Box that any toy company has ever made decides that he really likes this ballerina.
He's so creepy.
So he gets his creep on and starts, like, making his moves and then throwing stuff at this tin soldier and, like, knocks him out of a window by throwing a boat at him.
Okay, so he falls down in the sewer, and then there's a bunch of cockroaches, and that's gross. And then there's a bunch of rats, and that's creepy. And then there's a waterfall.
These rats, like, put the Lady and the Tramp rat to shame.
Seriously, they're very creepy rats.
Like, are nasty creepy rats, and there's a bajillion of them.
Rats do not bother me in the least, but these rats are very scary. And then he falls over this waterfall, and then he gets eaten by fish. And then the fishermen catch the fish, and then by sheer happenstance,
this is the Wind Teaches You English levels of coincidence and stretch in storytelling.
Oh, it's true. This is I'm the Lost Princess levels of plot points. So the fisherman happens to sell this one particular fish to the mother of the boy who owns the tin soldier.
Yep.
And then it falls out of the fish, and the kid treats it like no big deal. Like,
he's like, I've been looking for that.
Tin soldier must have snuck into the fish, you know, whatever.
So he puts it back And then that night at midnight... Oh, the toys come to life at midnight, by the way.
Yes.
A little animation of that. But that night, when the creepy Jack in the Box is trying to make his moves again, the Tin Soldier comes back.
Yep.
And they get in a fight.
In which the Jack in the Box mysteriously has a sword.
Yep.
That's not creepy.
And so, but he kind of like, he flips the Jack in the Box, slash the Jack in the Box overcompensates on his lunge, yes. And the Jack in the Box falls into the fireplace room furnace.
Yeah.
And is burnt
up.
Pretty
disturbing.
Leaving the
but then they're happy together.
Tin Soldier and the ballerina
Hooray.
To live happily ever after.
By
the way, this poor kid who, one, bought some toys and got a broken Tin Soldier in his set, then loses the Tin Soldier through no fault of his own. He did all the right stuff by putting his toys away, but nope, he loses the Tin Soldier anyway. Then, through no fault of his own, once again, his favorite Jack in the Box falls in a fireplace, and he loses that Jack in the Box.
It's true.
So this poor kid that just wants to, like, he's done everything right. He puts his toys away in the same spot every night. Everything that, like, I never did as a kid. And still he has to lose his toys.
It's true.
I felt so bad for that kid. He's the unsung hero of this tragedy.
Oh, so sad.
But, you know, for those who, like, know the original story, Tin Soldier, Steadfast Tin Soldier is actually, you know, a sad story.
Yeah.
That Disney had to happy up at the end.
Yeah.
So, but in this way, you can view it as a tragedy anyway.
So sad.
But I do. I really like this one. I do really like the animation. I think it serves the characters well.
Yeah.
This kind of, like, minimalist movement that they have. It really worked for the Jack in the Box, because that's a creepy looking Jack in the Box.
It's true, it's so creepy.
Next up is the Carnival of the Animals.
Yep.
Which is introduced by James Earl Jones.
It is.
Who, by the way, while James Earl Jones is talking, there's like a toy Mufasa sitting over his shoulder in the background.
I didn't even notice. That's adorable.
I had to rewind because I was not listening to James Earl Jones because I was too busy going, it's Mufasa! And the Mufasa voices! Up, up, up! I get what's going on.
Oh, that's adorable.
And there's also an animator who is, quote unquote, like, assisting James Earl Jones in this, and
yeah.
That is Eric Goldberg, who animated the genie, and there's a stuffed genie sitting on his desk.
Oh, I was wondering about
in
the
genie. Shot. Yep, that's why.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, Eric Goldberg animated the entire segment all by himself.
This entire segment?
Yep. He had just finished co-directing Pocahontas at the time and said he wanted to get back to the drawing board. And spent 9 months animating this segment.
What the hell? That's crazy.
So, I mean, comparatively, this is a really short segment.
That's true. But
like,
it's...
the idea of animating this by yourself.
Oh my goodness.
Is crazy pants.
Animation is so time consuming.
Yeah.
And it's all hand animated.
Mm-hmm.
The mind boggles. Okay, so this is the Carnival of the Animals. And I love that when James Earl Jones was introducing it, he was like, animators try and answer the question, what is man's relationship to nature? And he taps him on the shoulder, and he gives him a piece of paper, and he's like, or what would happen if you gave a yo-yo to a flock of flamingos? Oh, that's delightful. So it's a bunch of flamingos. There's like
the
six
fact
of them.
The fact that he had to say that sentence in that same James Earl Jones voice, that sounds like it should be narrating the most important documentaries of our time.
It's true. So there's a flock of flamingos. There's like six of them, I guess. And
there's six mean ones and then like one happy one.
One special snowflake. So there's a flock of flamingos, and they do, like, really nice, coordinated flamingo things, like walking around in water and doing little dancey things, and
standing up, going down.
Yep.
Very proper, very in sync. And then going along the music nicely.
They run into this other flamingo who has this yo-yo, and he's really into this yo-yo.
This flamingo has a look of sheer happiness that I would not have thought possible to draw onto a flamingo.
He's the most excited flamingo.
He's so content to just stand there and play with his yo-yo all day.
But no, the other flamingos. But these
six snotty flamingos.
Yep.
Have to ruin his fun.
Yep.
And then in contrast, when they force him into line, he again has the best face in the world, looking so disgruntled and sad at his lot in life.
I really enjoy his unhappy face. Which sounds so mean, but it's really funny.
It was so well done. He just looks so disgruntled at having to do these normal flamingo things.
Yep.
But like, and it's really impressive to, like, see this flamingo kind of get this idea of how to sneak his yo-yo in anyway. And he starts yo-yoing in the flamingo line.
Yep. And then everything goes kind of wrong, and there's this big traffic jam of flamingos.
And so these six flamingos basically beat down this special snowflake flamingo. And, like, force him to submit, and they're congratulating themselves at getting rid of his yo-yo, which they've thrown up into a tree. But he gets the last laugh because apparently
he's
this stockpile
like 80 of yo-yos.
And he's incredibly proficient at using all of them at the same time, which he does, grinning happily, disappointing all these flamingos.
So, once upon a time, a couple years ago, Joel and I went to a Star Wars convention, and in that Star Wars convention hotel that was next door to the convention center, there was also a yo-yoing competition going on. There were so many yo-yos, and I can honestly say that this is very accurate yo-yoing, because it looks just like walking through the lobby every day.
That's the thing, is, like, yeah, people who are good at yo-yo apparently are amazing at yo-yo and, like, defying physics with this little toy in ways I never thought possible.
It's true. And this flamingo should go to that competition.
Yeah, no, even though this flamingo is, like, a cartoon doing these crazy yo-yo things, I totally believe that it's possible to yo-yo like that.
Yep.
Because I've seen it.
It's true. So much yo-yo.
By the way, like, this idea was originally going to be, had ostriches instead of flamingos, and was originally conceived by Joe Grant, who, at the time of Fantasia 2000, was 91 years old and the head of story, and he is the only crew member to have worked both on Fantasia and Fantasia 2000.
Aww. So,
that's so cool that he got this in this movie. I'm really, really pleased with that.
That makes me happy.
Yep. Oh, so next is The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which we've talked about before.
In case you're not familiar.
On account of it's kind of the most important part of the original Fantasia.
Yep. Penn and Teller introduced this, though, and I love Penn and Teller.
Yep. I do like Penn and Teller.
They do a really funny bit about the difference between magic and tricks. And it's pretty delightful. Also, there are bunnies, yep. So, you know.
I actually really like that they put Sorcerer's Apprentice in this one again, because it was, you know, it kind of echoes the original idea of having some segments recur throughout Fantasias while having new ones. And even though, like, nowadays, because we have Blu-ray and DVD and stuff, and you can go out and buy a collection of the segments to, like, have and own and watch whenever, and you don't need to have multiple copies of the same segment, which I totally do, because I have Fantasia and I have Fantasia 2000, so I have bought two copies of this segment. I still think it echoes, like, the original idea, and it echoes going to a concert really well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I really enjoy that this segment is left in. We're not going to go through it again, obviously, because that would be a little redundant. If you want to listen to us talk about this, you can go listen to our Fantasia podcast. But it was really nice to see, especially in coordination with the next segment, which is based around Donald Duck. So,
yes. They also do a really cool little bit at the end of Sorcerer's Apprentice leading into this one, where they take the same footage of Mickey running up to shake Stokowski's hand after the bit, and then he's running across the stage, and we can see Stokowski still standing in the background.
Yeah.
As Mickey comes over to explain that they can't find Donald, and so if we could stall for a minute before starting the segment.
It's really cute.
Yep. But this segment is Pop and Circumstance. Yep. Oh, and when they did that in theaters, they were able to use IMAX's like multi-layer stereo system to like have Mickey's voice coming out of different spots in the theater.
Oh, that's cool.
So it really sounded like Mickey was running around the theater and like behind the audience and stuff.
That's cool.
So this segment is Pop and Circumstance, which is the graduation song.
Which is another one. Yeah, that everyone's familiar with, and they've taken a different take on it, which is really cool.
Yeah.
So this is based around Noah's Ark.
Yes, Noah's Ark with Donald helping, basically.
With Donald helping, which is a very similar plot line to Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Right.
Helping. we get introduced to a lot of the animals. I'm curious if they intentionally made the animals kind of look like animals from other movies, because the elephants look a lot like the elephants from The Jungle Book.
Yeah. Well,
and the eagles look like that giant one in The Rescuers Down Under, but, you know, it's kind of not that interesting of an animal to draw if you're trying to draw it fairly realistically, so.
Well, they show some frilled lizards go by, and that is totally Frank from The Rescuers Down Under.
Yeah.
Like, unquestionable. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of the other animals are at the very least, like, inspired by other Disney animals, if not necessarily copied. So this segment is, you know, it's Donald, you know, doing Donald stuff.
Yep.
Which, to me, is like makes it the absolute funniest segment in this.
My favorite part of this scene is when we get introduced to Donald and he's just lounging naked, which is super scandalous and really funny. And he's basically, he and Daisy basically lose each other on the boat, and they both think each other is dead, essentially, which is a little upsetting.
Oh, it's a really kind of, like, traumatic storyline to be so funny.
I know.
My favorite segment in this is when Donald is herding animals. One of the animals he herds is two ducks.
Ducks!
And he, like, deadpans to the camera for a second.
He, like, looks at these ducks and looks at the camera. Oh, it's so good.
So that cracked me up.
I also like there's like a pile of fictional animals laughing at all the other animals freaking on the boat. There's like a dragon and a unicorn and some sort of griffin.
I also really like Donald like refusing to use the animals and like pointing at the sun and laughing and then getting caught in this like instant rainstorm.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, the rain in this movie, or in this segment, is also the Rite of Spring rain. It's the exact same footage from Rite of Spring.
Oh, that's good, because that's a lot of rain.
Yep. And so, there's also a lot of, like, humorous slapstick on the boat with, like, the birds trying to drill holes, the woodpeckers trying to drill holes in the ark, which Donald's really upset about. There's a lot of, like, animals getting really close to getting eaten by the animal that would eat them on land.
It's true.
But then getting distracted or turned away somehow, which I really liked, because that's, like, often brought up when Noah's Ark is brought up. Like, it's like, oh, how those animals get along.
They don't.
And so they don't. That's fine.
And then the rain stops. Well, they try and send a, Donald tries to send a dove out, and the dove just keeps on to Mac on the other dove, and It doesn't work very well. But the rain stops, and the flood's pretty much done. The boat just gets, like, deposited on a cliff. Like, nope, no more flooding, we're done. We get to see all the animals leaving. With my favorite was, like, the bunnies who leave, and there's, like, 20 other baby bunnies. There's
extra baby bunnies. I really like that. I really like one of the hippos steps on Donald's toe, and we get, like, that really classic Donald putting his dukes up and hopping around angry shot. So that was, like, a really nice call to the really old Donald Duck cartoons, when Donald would get easily angry at things.
Yep. And then he and Daisy finally find each other again. It was so cute. So cute.
This is honestly, like, a really touching moment.
It is. Really nice.
Even after all the humorous slapstick stuff, I was getting a little choked up. They're like, oh, Daisy's happy again.
It's true.
Things work out. But because it was set to Pop and Circumstance, like, I still really thought about Graduation a lot, especially, like, when... Because a lot of the Pop and Circumstance, like, the really classical stuff you hear when people walk across the stage was animals walking up and down the gangplank. So...
Yeah.
It still felt like that. Even if you're trying to reimagine it, like, that still makes you feel... That sounds like walking in line.
Yep. In the stupid hats.
Yep. Although... like that noise, which, you know, I'm really familiar with, sounded at the beginning of the piece, and it was really weird to hear it at the beginning, since so many movies, like, end with Graduation. So it's like the kind of noise that ends a movie, and to hear it, like, open this one up, I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. but yeah, I really like this piece. I really like that it does echo Mickey in the original one, but it's not a copy. Like, it kind of has a step up and evolves, and it's just funny. It's been a long time since I've gotten to enjoy Donald Duck doing crazy stuff.
It's true. It's very much Donald Duck being Donald Duck, which is awesome.
Yep. And then we get to the final piece, which is the Firebird Suite, which is specified in the credits as the 1919 version. And not totally familiar with this piece. I don't know how important that is.
I'm mildly familiar with the ballet, but I don't know what that implies.
Yeah.
It's introduced by Angela Lansbury, though.
It is introduced by Angela Lansbury.
I know that one. Yeah, Angela Lansbury.
Very cool to see her in anything.
Hey.
So, apparently Walt Disney Pictures already had this piece under license, which, because they had acquired it the same time that they acquired Rite of Spring, because it was one of the possibilities for the original Fantasia. So this is another one that was not in public domain when they got it,
right?
So and it also really echoes, like, the way that they ended the first one with Bald Mountain.
With, like, a really spectacular, beautiful thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And kind of, like, also this, you know, the closest thing that you can get to, like, an antagonist of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the Firebird really kind of echoes that kind of, like, oh, bad guy, as much as you get bad guy in this.
Yep.
So the setup of the story is... The spirit of spring, or some sort of, like, spring sprite Mother Earth figure.
Yeah.
And she has this elk buddy. He wakes her up because it's time to start spring. And so she starts spring, and she's having a good old time making flowers and making trees.
She gets this mountain, and she tries to go... spread grass up the mountain, and it's not working. So she goes up to the top of the mountain, and there's this big crater, and I thought it was going to be something from space, to be honest, because I didn't remember the sequence very well. I was like, is there an alien? No, it's a volcano.
It's very specifically Mount St. Helen in 1980. They specifically wanted to make a spirit version of that eruption.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So, the volcano starts erupting. Oh my god, it scares me half to death because she, like, goes to poke at this figure, and then all of a sudden there's this, like, really loud bit of music, and the firebird wakes up, and I literally jumped a foot. It was pretty pathetic.
It was terrifying. This firebird is super scary.
It is.
And he burns up the world.
Yep. And there's all this lava everywhere, and everything is dying, and she's, like, trying to fix stuff, but it's not working, and she runs away a lot, and then she gets burned.
Yeah.
To death, kind
of. Like, she's kind of on this, like, last shred of safety tree, and she's... So, because she is a spirit and kind of a floating thing, she changes in size and amount. Like, at some point, she's flowing over this, like, whole landscape, and then, you know, and she kind of shrinks down to a person. And so she's shrunken down to, like, her smallest form, and the firebird has, like, grown into this massive, towering bird of fire. but, like... And I was like, it's this bird, but that's why they call it a firebird, I guess.
Yeah.
Who'd have thunk? But, like, he just covers her in fire. Like, completely overpowers in... So it's, like, just utter destruction everywhere.
It's really distressing.
It is. And,
then...
Like, and then there's this, like, after-the-fact
kind everything
of wasteland.
Is ash... But the elk is okay, and the elk goes and, like, nudges at some ashes, and his friend is okay, kind of. She's very small and all made of ash again.
She's
but
sad, and she's defeated, and, like, he kind of, like, encourages her to...
And she starts to
return
cry,
to her former state.
And the rain, and her tears make plants, and then she makes rain. And then the trees start to grow. Lots of trees! And there's butterflies! And then she covers the volcano in leaves and grass and stuff. She's like, nope, no more volcano. None for you. It's really pretty.
Well, it's really nice. It's a really beautiful way to end this.
Yes.
Like, and there's this, like, one final shot where, like, you know, it's showing the landscape and she, like, explodes in front of the camera and takes up the whole screen. And she just has this, like, look of complete happiness and joy and contentment. And it's really, really touching to be able to see that. This is the piece that impresses me the most in that they're able to tell such a clear and powerful story just using music and pictures.
Yeah.
This is
my favorite from this movie, I think. It's just, it's really, really beautiful. The landscape is gorgeous, and I stared at that elk's antlers like nobody's business, because I was like, antlers are hard. Disney has taught me this. And the elk was gorgeous, and the firebird was scary, and the lava was really good, and it's just, it's a really, really beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah, no, it's crazy, crazy beautiful. By the way, the horns were CGI rendered in this one on top of hand-drawn animation.
Horns are hard. I learned that. So I paid attention this time, and I greatly appreciate them.
Let me just admire your horns, Disney. But I really thought that this is cool. The final piece was my favorite in the original Fantasia, Night on Bald Mountain, and this was just a really cool... And it's as much a successor as anything, I suppose, because, you know, because of it ending the piece and having the quote-unquote bad guy for the movie in it. But I really liked how it was the same and how it was different. And that's true for the whole movie. It never feels like it's copying or restricted to trying to imitate the original Fantasia.
No.
It pays respect to it really well, especially, like, in the beginning, with the, like, brief mentions of Fantasia as an ongoing project, and continues well from there in a way that both feels like it's a new contemporary thing, but at the same time can and will be a classic for future generations the way Fantasia is for us.
Right. So I completely agree. It was great to watch, and I'm really crossing my fingers that they'll keep doing this, because I think it's a really cool idea.
Absolutely. I don't want to wait 60 years for the next Fantasia.
No.
So
I want all the Fantasias. And they, you know,
that's the thing, is like, this Fantasia was much, much shorter than the other Fantasia.
Yeah.
And part of that was because there was stuff that was, you know, kind of cut out, and ideas that have not been used yet. So they have other Fantasia stuff. I still haven't seen Ride of the Valkyries. Like,
nope.
They talked about that in the special features on Fantasia, and I was like, I would really like to see that. That looks really interesting.
Yes, please.
So let's do that. So yeah, it's something that I hope is continued. Fantasia 2000 did not make a ton of money, which is really frustrating.
This seems like a Fantasia trend. That is so unfortunate.
And so, you know, that it might be longer than we'd like before Fantasia 3, the Squeaklogy, comes out.
You did not just make that reference. Jeez, Joel.
So, but yeah, that's Fantasia 2000. I highly, highly recommend you go and watch that.
It was fabulous. Go watch it.
It's kind of one that doesn't, you know, is not referenced a lot. Kind of has the double whammy of being in the shadow of the original Fantasia and in the shadow of the whole Disney Renaissance. So it really gets kind of stuck away. But it's one that I had not seen since, I guess, 2000, since I watched it on VHS.
Yeah.
And I remember there being, you know, a little bit of putsy when the Blu-ray came out, because both Fantasia and Fantasia 2000 were released from the vault on the same disc, and there was kind of this hubbub about, oh, I have to get Fantasia 2000 if I want Fantasia, grumble, grumble. But, like, after this viewing, I was like, oh, I totally kind of see that as completely worthy successor, and I definitely want both of those, and am happy to pay for it.
Yes, you should be.
So, it's great. I almost forgot. This made me laugh.
Wait.
Staying through the whole credits, you know, and enjoying the music all over again, at the very end of the credits, Steve Martin is still going, camera back on me? Anyone? Anyone? Camera back on me? Is my part over?
That's really funny. I didn't notice that.
It's this voiceover of Steve Martin. He goes, can someone take me home, please?
Oh, that's awesome.
So that might be my favorite after the credits joke in all of Disney.
I might have to agree.
So, but next week will be Dinosaur, which I've never seen.
Neither have I. This is the first movie since probably one of the package films that both of us haven't seen.
Yeah, no, I would believe it. I remember Dinosaur coming out. I remember seeing, like, the posters for it and the teasers and thinking, like, this is going to be, like, action-packed Godzilla Jurassic Park-style movie.
I remember seeing trailers and thinking, this looks kind of boring.
Well, like, it was right at the time where I was able to, you know, start seeing PG-13 movies, and, like, that's what I was really looking forward to. And, like, it was, like, slapping Walt Disney on. I was like, oh. Well, excuse me, then. So, I'm looking forward to it. It's, you know, it's interesting and exciting. What's it going to be about? I have no idea what this movie is about, other than a dinosaur.
Okay, I know there's, like, a dinosaur, and I think he's raised by, like, lemur things, and then he falls in love with another dinosaur. Lemurs. Probably something about, like, you know, the apocalypse or whatever. Not the apocalypse. The comet hitting the earth. The comet, apocalypse. Yeah. The dinosaur apocalypse.
The dinosaur apocalypse.
Their apocalypse. They get one. I know that all I've seen of it is very gray and brown. That's about all I got.
We have had to watch dinosaurs die out once already in this series of watching the movies, so I hope I don't have to watch all the dinosaurs die again.
I hope at the very least that this movie will not be as disturbing as the dinosaur sequence from the original Fantasia, because that kind of scared me.
All right, well, we will find out next week when we're watching Dinosaur. Until then, bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.